This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, the Obama administration is wrapping up details as they prepare to make way for the incoming Trump administration. The president put his signature on the groundbreaking 21st Century Cures Bill, his last major piece of legislation before leaving office. But he's also taking action to ensure that certain health programs remain unscathed moving forward.
And the Obama administration ordered the finalization of a new rule at the Department of Health and Human Services that ensures $500 million earmarked for health care and family planning through Planned Parenthood's hundreds of clinics throughout the country can't be tampered with. HHS finalized a new rule that ensures states cannot discriminate against qualified health providers for offering family planning services. Clearly a bold action.
There is much concern that Planned Parenthood could experience severe cutbacks in the new administration. They provide frontline care for millions of mostly poor Americans to fill a big need, especially in those states that did not expand Medicaid. This new rule keeps funding intact, much of which comes from the Medicaid budget, and ensures that patients get preventative screening as well as family planning.
Well, and Mark, it's important to remind our listeners that no federal funds are used for abortion services at Planned Parenthood, which accounts for only about 3% of the services they actually provide. And also interesting to note that many women are very concerned about losing access to birth control services. And we're hearing reports of women flooding provider offices across the country with requests for long-term contraceptives, probably thinking that these services may not be covered under new configurations in the Affordable Care Act.
Our guest today is very well versed in the improvements that have occurred in the American healthcare since the passage of the ACA. Sarah Collins is Vice President of Healthcare Coverage and Access at the Commonwealth Fund, which is dedicated to fostering the growth of high-quality healthcare systems for all Americans. She's been closely charting the impact of tens of millions of Americans gaining access to health coverage since the passage of Obamacare. She has some interesting data that highlights the important impact already made on population health.
And Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org, stops by. She is always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Sarah Collins in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. With talk of an imminent repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act under the Trump administration, state-based Medicaid directors are scrambling to prepare for what could be a big shift in policies affecting their departments in coming years. Millions of Americans gained coverage under the Affordable Care Act through the law's Medicaid expansion, which provided full funding for states to expand coverage to broader sectors of their populations living near the poverty line. 31 states expanded Medicaid, including California, which has the highest percentage of state residents now covered through their program, known as Medi-Cal. It's uncertain at this time how many Americans will lose coverage in the wake of repeal and replace as that reality unfolds. In the meantime, healthcare has been the fastest growing job sector in the wake of the 2008 economic collapse and ensuing recession. The healthcare law has actually led to hiring growth throughout the sector. Now, a study out of UC Berkeley warns full repeal of the Affordable Care Act could cost the state of California some 208,000 jobs. Study found not only would those in lower economic sectors lose health coverage, many would also lose health care jobs. The study predicts the repeal of the ACA would cost 63,000 jobs in Los Angeles County alone. The Berkeley study isn't the only indicator of significant job losses should the GOP leadership succeed in repealing the Affordable Care Act. Both the American Hospital Association and the Federation of American Hospitals, the two largest lobbying organizations for the hospital industry, warn there could be significant, even dire, loss of income, leading to massive layoffs should repeal go through. According to a piece in Modern Healthcare, health economist Dobson, Davanzo and Associates warn that based on the latest ACA repeal bill put forth, loss of coverage for millions of Americans would lead to a net loss to hospitals of some $168 billion. Both trade groups sent a letter to President-elect Trump urging him to consider the economic as well as health implications when putting forth any repeal legislation. and need medical attention? Want to live longer? Your chances may be better with a female doctor. According to results from a long-term study recently published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, women doctors do a better job at keeping patients healthier longer. At least according to these statistics, researchers at Harvard examined a random sample of Medicare patients hospitalized between January 2011 and December 2014, treated by general internists, looking at more than 1.5 million hospitalizations. Patients who saw a female doctor were less likely to die within 30 days of leaving the hospital. They were also less likely to get readmitted within a one-month span of their initial discharge. Harvard School of Health researcher Dr. Ashish Shah noted that women physicians are more likely to do evidence-based medicine and follow clinical guidelines. Also the co-author of the report, he surmised women doctors are more likely to communicate in a way patients report is simply more effective. Hospital administrators are hyper-conscious now about hospital readmissions, which can lead to costly fines as well as poor patient outcomes, and women physicians are often paid less than their male counterparts. Jha sees this longitudinal study as proof such pay inequality is not only unfair, it's inefficient. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Sarah Collins, Ph.D., Vice President for Healthcare Coverage and Access at the Commonwealth Fund, a private foundation which aims to promote a high-functioning healthcare system, improving access, especially for the nation's most vulnerable population. She led the fund's national program on health insurance since 2005, conducting a number of national surveys on health insurance and the impact of gaining coverage. She served as the associate director of the New York Academy of Medicine and served as the associate editor at U.S. News and World Report, as well as senior economist at Health Economics Research. She earned her Ph.D. in economics from George Washington University. Sarah, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Very nice to be here.
So, 100 years old. Congratulations. My God. And obviously, the fund has done so much with a particular mandate to support independent research on healthcare issues. You oversee the fund's analysis of the insurance coverage and access to care, which is safe to say has made some dramatic advances in recent years. In fact, since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, the uninsured rate in this country is at a historic low. And I'm wondering if you could maybe put this in context to the mission that you have and the foundation's goals for the past century.
You know, the Commonwealth Fund was founded in 1918 with a broad charge to, quote, do something for the welfare of mankind. And the foundation's first president, Edward Harkness, thought that healthcare was a primary way to fulfill that mission because health was key to ensuring that people could achieve their full potential. And there were many gaps at the time in people's ability to get healthcare, just like they are now, but maybe a much worse level. Early grants by the fund included some for medical research. We provided funding for research that led to the Pap test, screening for cervical cancer. And we also made grants to establish hospitals in rural areas of the United States that lacked medical facilities. If you fast forward to the 21st century, it became increasingly clear that health insurance coverage is the key to ensuring that people can get the health care that they need. But the rates of people who were uninsured kept going up, and people were increasingly reporting that they're not able to get the health care that they needed. So we really began to fund research in this area, and we've just continued that over time.
Well, Sarah, one of the areas that you're very expert in is Medicaid and the impact of Medicaid on health and healthcare and coverage, particularly for the most vulnerable among us. And perhaps the most effective access route to health coverage since the passage of the Affordable Care Act happened because of the Medicaid expansion in so many states. And you just released a Medicaid fact sheet at Commonwealth that puts this expansion into perspective and what it really means in terms of the access of the American people to health care. Can you share some of those facts with our listeners, and how has the Medicaid expansion changed the landscape for Americans?
Well, the expansion of the Medicaid program under the Affordable Care Act has made it one of the nation's largest health insurers. And in those 31 states and the District of Columbia that you mentioned that have expanded, an estimated 13.3 million people have gained coverage since October of 2013. But even in the 19 states that have yet to expand Medicaid eligibility, about 2.4 million people enrolled in these states' existing Medicaid programs, so they're programs that they had prior to the Affordable Care Act. people found out they were eligible after the Affordable Care Act passed for Medicaid. And the other major change that the Affordable Care Act made in the Medicaid program was simplifying enrollment. So people, even in these states that haven't expanded Medicaid, are finding it much easier to sign up. So we've just seen a big surge in enrollment. The Commonwealth Fund Affordable Care Act Tracking Survey, where we sample people who have new coverage under Medicaid and coverage through the marketplaces, we've been running the survey since 2013. But we found that 3 of 5 of these newly insured adults in the Medicaid program were uninsured prior to gaining their new coverage. And half were either uninsured for more than 2 years or never had health insurance coverage.
And the other side of the coin, the insurance exchange market, while millions have gained coverage on the exchanges, the numbers are smaller than in the Medicaid group. But your study found this sector of insurance buying population still had a big impact on the health economy. What has the economic impact been, not only in gaining coverage, but also in reducing economic vulnerability in the event of catastrophic illnesses?
Well, about 10 million people have coverage through the marketplaces now, and also about an estimate 8 million people have coverage in the individual market outside of the exchanges. But we've found through our surveys that marketplace coverage has improved access to health care for people who are enrolled and improved the affordability of health plans that people buy on their own. Prior to the Affordable Care Act's passage, the individual market was just notoriously difficult to navigate. People were often turned down because of pre-existing conditions. And about 60% of people told us in 2010 who had tried to buy a plan in the individual market couldn't find a plan they could afford. More than a third were turned down because of a pre-existing health condition. So the changes that the marketplaces and the regulations for that whole market have just really had a dramatic effect on people who don't have coverage through a job and have to buy it on their own. In our tracking survey, we've asked people in each year that we've run it who have marketplace coverage and Medicaid as well, so we asked if they'd use their plans to get health care, whether they would have been able to access or afford this care prior to getting their new coverage. Among people with marketplace plans, about 51% said they would not have been able to access or afford that care prior to getting their new coverage. But even large shares of people who previously had insurance noted an improved ability to get health care. And marketplace enrollees have consistently reported high rates of satisfaction with their health plans. About 60% have incomes under 250% of poverty, so they are eligible for the most generous premium tax credits and also reduced cost sharing in the form of lower deductibles and lower copays. About a third are young adults, ages 19 to 34, and about a third are older adults, 50 and older. So the goal was to make coverage affordable for people who are most at risk of not having coverage through an employer. And we found that people with incomes under 250% of poverty paid about the same in premiums as people in that income range in the survey who had employer plans. So those cost-sharing subsidies and the premium tax credits have really made health plans as affordable that people have to buy on their own as people in employer-based plans. The law has also created a number of consumer protections that guard against catastrophic losses. The Essential Health Benefit Package ensures that everybody has a comprehensive insurance package, bans on pre-existing condition exclusions. There are bans on lifetime benefit limits, so health plans can't cut off your health coverage when you hit a certain amount, a certain dollar amount like they did in the past. There are also bans on insurers canceling people's policies when they become sick. This was a big problem prior to the Affordable Care Act. And there are also annual out-of-pocket limits. So if you get sick and you are spending quite a bit of money on your health care, there's a limit to how much you'll have to spend.
Well, Sarah, there's been so much progress. Most Americans still gain access to health coverage through their employers. And as unemployment has dropped, that presumably has gone up as well. There's higher deductibles and higher out-of-pocket costs for almost all health care consumers. And many attempt to lay the blame at the feet of Obamacare somehow for this trend, which you say is misleading. So what's really driving this rise in the out-of-pocket costs for the health consumer?
You know, there was this expectation when the law passed that because people would have access to subsidized insurance coverage through the marketplaces of Medicaid, that employers might feel less obligated to offer health insurance. But we really haven't seen that effect at all. About 57% of people under age 65 have coverage through an employer. And that's close to what it was prior to the Affordable Care Act. So it just, the Affordable Care Act really hasn't affected employer coverage. Some of the critics of the Affordable Care Act have claimed that the law is driving higher premium and deductible costs for businesses and their workers. But we found in a recent study of federal data that premiums in employer health plans actually grew more slowly on average in the 5 years following the passage of the Affordable Care Act than they did in the 5 years prior to the law's passage. What employees have to contribute to their health insurance premiums also rose more slowly in the years after the law passed. And the reason why so many families feel pinched by their health care costs, even though we're seeing a slowdown in premiums, is that income growth really hasn't kept pace with health care costs in many areas of the United States. We found that employee contributions to their premiums, along with their deductible amounts, amounted to about 10.1% of U.S. median income in 2015, and this is up from about 6.5% of median income in 2006. So what people are paying for their premiums and their deductibles as a share of their income has gone up because their incomes haven't risen fast enough to keep pace with those higher costs. And deductibles are a real problem for people in employer-based plans as well as in plans that they buy on their own.
We're speaking today with Sarah Collins, PhD, Vice President for Healthcare Coverage and Access at the Commonwealth Fund, a private foundation that aims to promote a high-functioning healthcare system, improving access to healthcare, especially to the nation's most vulnerable population. Sarah, President-elect Trump has obviously talked during the campaign about immediately setting to work to repeal the health law, which has been certainly a rallying cry for the GOP majority since the law passed in 2009. How does the Commonwealth Fund view the potential impact of repeal and replace? Walk us through some of those scenarios.
Things are rather uncertain right now. President-elect Trump and congressional Republicans have promised to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. They are now planning to repeal parts of the law, such as the subsidies that help people afford marketplace plans and the Medicaid expansion, through a congressional process known as budget reconciliation. They would include with that, they would do that with a 2 to 3 year transition to allow them to come up with a replacement for the Affordable Care Act. Congressional Republicans would then replace the Affordable Care Act sometime in the future. And they also pledged to block grant the Medicaid program, so significantly change how that program is financed just by taking some sum of money and giving it to states. But a repeal could destabilize the individual insurance market. One of the proposals is to eliminate the penalties for not having health insurance coverage, so eliminating the individual mandate effectively by removing the penalties that people have to pay if they don't have health insurance coverage, leaving the people who would be most likely to drop their coverage would be healthier, so you might trigger the exits of insurers from market. And it also creates a lot of uncertainty for the 31 states that expanded Medicaid, especially since there is great uncertainty as to what the replacement would look like, what that block grant would mean, how much money states would actually expect to get for their programs. If they're repealing the Medicaid expansion, does that mean that they would have a lot fewer dollars to cover people? So just really tremendous uncertainty. The Urban Institute projects an increase of 30 million people without insurance coverage just under a repeal scenario like what we might see through such a reconciliation process. This is nearly 60 million people more than were without coverage prior to the Affordable Care Act. In terms of replace, what are we likely to see? The current proposals and legislation, including proposals by Congressman Ryan and Price and Senators Burr, Hatch, and Upton, include flat tax credits that would replace the kinds of means-tested tax credits we have now under the Affordable Care Act that are pegged to premiums and people's incomes. Replacing the individual mandate insurance carriers in order to participate in the marketplaces and make sure that people aren't charged more on the basis of their health anymore, you have to maintain a pretty broad risk pool. So one idea is to provide people a one-time open enrollment period and require them to then maintain continuous coverage across their lifetime. So people would have one time to enroll and then have to maintain that coverage throughout their lives or be charged higher premiums or face penalties. But this really doesn't fit the reality of people's lives. People move in and out of their jobs. They get married. They get divorced. Over 2004 to 2007, 89 million people were uninsured for at least 1 month. So that this type of replacement for the individual mandate really doesn't fit how people's lives unfold over the course of a year. Just a note on the state high risk pools. So if you didn't maintain continuous coverage and you couldn't find an affordable plan, you might have to get coverage through a high-risk pool. There's been considerable experience in the United States with high-risk pools. This approach is both very expensive for enrollees and also for the federal government, and generally they're ultimately unsustainable over time.
Well, Sarah, I guess when you look at the current landscape, are there areas of bipartisan agreement on what ought to happen? Are there some elements? And we certainly heard during the campaign, everybody said that there were things that could be improved and, you know, maybe would have been improved if there'd been more of a bipartisan focus. But where do you think there's opportunity for some bipartisan support of changes to the Affordable Care Act?
Well, there are definitely challenges in the Affordable Care Act right now. They are eminently fixable. One of the problems that we see in our survey data, if your income is higher, then the subsidies start to phase out and what you pay in premiums grows. People also have higher deductibles at higher income levels in marketplace plans. So those subsidies could be increased. People with higher incomes could be made eligible for more generous tax credits. They could also be made eligible for the cost-sharing subsidies that have helped so many lower and moderate-income families. So the other thing that happened this year, we saw higher premiums in most state marketplaces. A key reason for this year was the phase-out of a program that was designed to keep premium costs low and to help cover the health insurers' costs when they have an enrollee that has a very expensive medical event. But the law has really been successful in terms of covering millions of people, reducing people's out-of-pocket costs, and rather than thinking about repealing the entire law, about making the parts of it that aren't working very well function more efficiently. Policymakers really have to work together to improve those programs over time as they evolve.
Sarah, any change in the direction of Commonwealth Fund, change of administration, maybe change of focus? Have you sat back and reflected on the election and made any strategic change, or Commonwealth Fund pretty much having a longer-term vision?
Well, we're continuing to survey people about their health insurance coverage. We will be interviewing people over the next year or so just to identify problems that people may have gaining health insurance coverage. We will certainly be monitoring the individual insurance market, the marketplaces, for problems that may arise as a result of efforts to repeal the law. So we will continue our focus on tracking insurance coverage in the United States. We view health insurance coverage, universal health insurance coverage, as a central part of achieving a high-performing health care system overall. Everyone has to have health insurance coverage, so we'll be looking for places where people may be losing their coverage and addressing policy options to help improve coverage.
We've been speaking today with Sarah Collins, Vice President for Healthcare Coverage and Access at the Commonwealth Fund, a private foundation that seeks to promote a high-functioning healthcare system. You can learn more about their work by going to commonwealthfund.org, or you can follow her on Twitter by going to @SarahCollins_. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, factcheck.org took a look at the biggest political falsehoods or whoppers of 2016. Among them were several healthcare claims. For instance, Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton pushed for policies to lower prescription drug costs, but early in 2016, she misleadingly claimed in a TV ad that, quote, in the last 7 years, drug prices have doubled. The report cited by her campaign said brand name drug prices, on average, had more than doubled, but more than 80% of filled prescriptions are for generic drugs, which have seen a price drop of nearly 63%. During the primary debates, Senator Ted Cruz claimed that millions had lost jobs and been forced into part-time work because of the Affordable Care Act, but job statistics at the time didn't back that up. The economy had added millions of jobs since the employer mandate, and fewer people were working part-time for economic reasons. In discussing the wait time scandal at the Department of Veterans Affairs, President Obama suggested that his administration fired a whole bunch of people who were in charge of some of these facilities. At the time of Obama's remark, only 9 people had been fired from the VA for issues pertaining to patient wait times, according to VA documents. Of those 9, 4 were senior officials at one facility in Phoenix. That's not a whole bunch of people who were in charge, considering USA Today reported employees at 40 VA facilities manipulated data indicating how long veterans waited for appointments, including supervisors in at least 7 states who instructed employees to falsify data. In the realm of fake news, fake medical records for Clinton circulated on social media and some conservative websites, purporting to show that she suffers from seizures and dementia. Clinton's longtime physician released a statement to factcheck.org calling the documents false and reiterating her diagnosis that Clinton was, quote, in excellent health and fit to serve as president of the United States. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
Factcheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Pregnancy is normally an exciting time for most women, but according to research, an estimated 10% of prenatal women experience some kind of depression during their pregnancy, and many are reluctant to treat their depression with medication for fear of harming the fetus.
In fact, a higher percentage are experiencing lower grade depressive symptoms, so they might not meet full criteria for a major depressive episode, but they're having significant symptoms that are getting in the way of feeling good, and left untreated, those mild to moderate symptoms can progress, in some cases lead to a more serious postpartum depression.
Dr. Cynthia Battle is a psychologist at Brown University with a practice at Women's and Infants Hospital in Providence. She and her colleagues decided to test a cohort of pregnant women to see if a targeted prenatal yoga class, which combines exercise with mindfulness techniques, might have a positive impact on women dealing with prenatal depression.
And it was a typical kind of hatha yoga that would include physical postures, breathing exercises, meditation exercises. And we enrolled 34 women who were pregnant who had clinical levels of depression. They all had medical clearance from their prenatal care providers, and they would come to classes, and we measured their change in depressive symptoms over that period of time.
Not only were women able to manage their depressive incidents, they also bonded with other pregnant women during the program and found additional support from their group.
And the initial signs from this research are really encouraging. So we found that women, on average, were reporting that they were reporting much less.
A larger study with control groups is being planned with the assistance of the National Institute of Mental Health.
Women who are depressed during pregnancy, unfortunately, do often have less ideal birth outcomes. So one thing we're interested in seeing if when we provide prenatal yoga program, can it improve mood? And then can we even see some positive effects in terms of the birth outcomes?
A guided non-medical yoga exercise program designed to assist pregnant women through depression symptoms helping them successfully navigate those symptoms without medication, ensuring a safer pregnancy and a healthier outcome for mother and baby. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.